Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell, and when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Back to breaking down the Nancy Guthrie investigation. We're going to take it from a different angle this morning. ABC News reporting Friday that sources inside the investigation believe the case may soon be transitioning to a smaller, longer-term task force. The first official signal that 400 investigators working 24/7 for 3 weeks isn't sustainable without results. The family has been briefed, apparently, that leads are not necessarily panning out and the DNA is still unidentified. No additional video has been recovered. No vehicle has been associated with the abduction. Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. And of course, I'm sure that reporting is going to be contradicted if it isn't already by somebody, because that's how this works. One person says something, the next person says, nope. Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, is here with us to help break down where we're going here. Robin, let's talk about this. I mean, realistically, we are talking a week, 4 weeks in now, almost a full month into this investigation with 400 full-time investigators. And then you got a smaller task force working alongside. And the family has been briefed, apparently. You know, certain leads, they're not panning out. In your experience, you know, running investigations, running FBI programs under sustained pressure, what does this look like? What does this transition moment look like? Are we in a transition moment? I guess maybe we should start there, as we're a month in and still not a whole lot has materialized.
Yeah, it's actually pretty standard what's going on. And interesting words, you know, not much has materialized that we know of, but there's a lot always going on behind the scenes. I'll take you kind of my impressions about what I would be feeling, because anything else is conjecture, because we're not getting the inside scoop from the lead investigator on this one. But I always liked it when things started getting to this point during my investigations, during our operations, because the noise is stopping. And what I mean by that is, so you have an initial surge of people and resources coming in because you have such a massive volume and you really don't know quite which direction to go in. I mean, you're going to have the typical profile based on reps and past experiences that you're going to typically focus on. But you have, as we've seen, sometimes tens of thousands of leads that come in, and you need a lot of resources to run those down. Plus, you have the digital forensic side, the standard forensic side. And then you have the interviews that have to be done. There's an immense volume of things that have to be done. And every single one of these 400 people that come in, this is a collateral duty. This is an add-on to their otherwise really important work every day as well, their own case backlog of things that are important. So being able to get, you know, for that 400 that came in, being able to go back to their primary job is really important for all these other critical investigations, as well as for the lead investigators themselves, because they're trying to not only manage the investigation, but manage all the people, you know. And then a lot of times these people are brought in for a public show sometimes that they want to show the public, you know, hey, that this is so important. We're bringing all these resources in. Meanwhile, you have a lot of people potentially at this point starting to twiddle their thumbs every day, wondering what they're going to be doing. It's like during 9/11, I used to sit on the Intrepid aircraft carrier, which is a museum, because our building got shut down. And we reported at 6 a.m. in the morning. I sat on the floor of the aircraft carrier with my squad, and you waited for someone to come by and hand you a lead, a paper lead that said, go do this. Mm-hmm. One did that. You came back, you sat on the floor, and you waited again until the surge ended. And our surge lasted from 9/11, probably just past through Christmas, when we actually started going back to our day jobs again. This one, obviously, is a bit different. But it allows the lead investigators to kind of keep focusing in on that center core of what they need to be doing and processing. So this is standard. This is normal. I'm not seeing anything unusual in this. And they say that some leads are panning out. Of course, they're not panning out. I mean, that's the way these things work. So I'm not seeing anything really unusual in this. You're seeing the public side of the mouthpieces that spout things that are, like you say, sometimes they this way, flip-flop, wind blows, whatever. But I'm still pretty solid on what we're seeing lead investigators doing, because I still am very confident there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. Doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be solved fast or quick, or it will ever be solved at all. We're hopeful of that. But I still think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes, and they're able to narrow their focus.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a way, or is there a reality here where sometimes there's just the simplicity of there's too many cooks in the kitchen. There's too many people that are involved in one thing. And then that, you know, as well-intentioned as it may be, ends up working against the greater, you know, goal here of figuring out what happened to Nancy Guthrie.
Yeah. But at this point, I don't think so. I think they're pretty solid, you know, because there's always, I've seen this in numerous cases, and it's so many things over so long, that you always have, you know, the public affairs side of things. And very rarely, if ever, do you ever hear from the lead investigator themselves. They're the ones that are just keeping the blind eye, not watching the media, not watching social things, not running an investigation based on public opinion. They're really zeroed in and focused on the things, the data that's coming in that is important. And then you have the public face of things, which are people like the sheriff and all that is the other noise that's going on, that are trying to give little glimpses of what they know, or what they're guessing at maybe sometimes, of what the investigation actually is. So there's actually two sides of this. The one on the ground is the one that we don't know as much about. And I like that we're not getting a lot of different leakage, because we're still seeing some momentum. In my opinion, it's not vast, but I think it's relentless at this point still. I'm still hopeful, just because there's still more to do. I don't think everything's flushed out yet.
What do you make of what we have seen publicly? Two people have been publicly detained and released in the investigation. I'm not going to say their names. They don't need it. But and they're both like, yeah, we had nothing, and they don't have anything to do with it. Both turned out to have no connection to the case. When you have, you know, people get into being detained publicly, you know, and if it turns out to be absolutely nothing, I guess walk me through a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes here, where they're getting leads in over here. Then it's eventually, you know, getting to an agent. And then, as we've seen in some of these cases, you have people detained temporarily and then released. You know, is it what sort of how do they determine what weight to put on these things? Because you got everybody and their brother, I'm sure, calling, and some certainly have really valid leads. Others have voices that came to them through their tinfoil hat that are telling them what's going on. And not all of it you're going to know if it came through the tinfoil hat or it's something viable, depending on how they're explaining their information to you. So how are they prioritizing and understanding, okay, this is one we really need to go detain somebody, or this is one where, you know, we just need to go, you know, chat it up with somebody at a coffee shop or drive by a location or something?
It goes through multiple filters is what, I mean, it's the easiest way to kind of think about it. You know, my visual representation. So every lead comes in at this base level through a tip line, through investigation, we'll just call it through the base level of like a tip line coming in. And what happens is it filters through that first level of, is it plausible? Is it real? Is it, you know, all these different kind of wickets, you know, to kind of flush out to the next level of, all right, we need to take a little bit deeper dive on this. And if it falls into the realm of a possibility, then they start looking at all these other investigative things they're doing. Does it overlap in any way? So in other words, if someone calls in a tip, hey, I think my friend is acting weird and he looks a little different and he came back and he's got a full backpack. He left with an empty one, or he left with a full one, came back with an empty, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. What they're now going to do is they're now going to take that tip. They're going to interview the person that sent it in, and if they can get them. And if they can't get them, then they're going to kind of put it on the side to see if any of these other data points flush out to can corroborate the information that they're calling in on a tip line. Or if they can interview them, they're going to assess the person that sent it in, if they're credible or not. And so all these different things kind of are happening before it even reaches a lead investigator. So they keep doing all these filters to flush it out as it's making its way towards the top. Now, if it passes all these wickets, so say we have someone, one of these two individuals that were detained and questioned, it passed all these wickets, made it up to the lead investigator. And by the time it reached the lead investigator, they had enough data and information to fill out a probable cause thing that's going to go to the judge and say, hey, we have probable cause for detention or interview, whatever it is they want to do, so they can flush out that final level to see word of mouth from them, an alibi, what they can say about all the data they have, explain this away, because it reaches that point where like, hey, this is a possible because all these data points that we have are aligning. We need to go talk to this individual, and they go talk to them and they can corroborate their location and all the things. And so all the data kind of falls apart. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily completely off the radar, but it's been pushed aside as lower level noise.
Yeah. Yeah, and there seems to have been, I mean, there seems to be, there's a lot of things going on here. You have obviously what the public is perceiving, which at the end of the day doesn't mean anything. The investigation is the investigation, and we hope to God they're doing a good job. Publicly out here from everybody watching on the ether goes, oh, well, this looks rather confusing. And I don't know how confusing it truly is on the inside or how confused we are, because there's so many voices coming out with so many different things on this. Well, this person is contradicting that person. I mean, is this a case too? Is this a new product of the world that we live in, where it's not only that we have too many cooks in the kitchen going on here, but we have too many reporters reporting. And I'm not in any way trying, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about all of the social people out there. We're getting better information from the social reporters than we are network reporters. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say that. So don't anybody take it as that. But you also, when you have that many voices and you have that many different modalities of communication, each one seemingly to have a little bit different in terms of their journalistic ethics and how they communicate and what they're going to do to get information and what they're willing to say publicly as information comes in. Some, you know, you normally pause on, is this something I should put out there into the ether? Someone's name, someone's identity who's just being questioned right now. Typically, you know, more old school journalism, you're going to take a beat on that. And you're going to wait because you don't want to get sued, number one. And you also don't want to ruin someone's life. But we have this, you know, level of new journalism, if you will, that goes on. Some understand the importance of that. Some do. And some just simply don't care. It's all about getting the clicks. Is more the confusion coming here on this case simply because this is, we haven't seen a case like this in God knows for how long. And we have never seen a case quite like this being run through the filter of the state of media reporting today. It's never existed like this before.
Yeah, all those things are definitely playing in. And I think the clickbait plays a large part of this because, you know, you want to report something new when there's really nothing new to report. So that's where conjecture comes in. I mean, I saw it on, I was looking at one of the news feeds this morning about, you know, I mean, just, so here's a great example. So they're saying that the Pena County Sheriff is now saying there's possibility of other people involved. That's not new. But see, but now they're twisting that and using it as other people are involved. No, it's not actually what's said. There's always a possibility someone else is involved until you flush that out. So, but see, people are running with something that sounds different because it's different. So they may, and they think they got the lead and they got the break. And so it kind of escalates from there. Meanwhile, it's nothing really new. And part of it also comes from, and I saw the comments from our listeners, you know, with the confusion from the sheriff. Yeah, you know, from what, again, only from what we're hearing from social media and some, I think ABC put a lot of this out too, you know, there's some rift between, you know, the sheriff and some internal people going on. And so here's some conjecture about why we could get mixed messaging. So the sheriff is elected to really be the face of the department and he's put out there. And so he's the one that's the mouthpiece of all things that are going on. But if you have people internally, as has been reported, that are not a big fan of his in some way, and then they're going to not tell him everything that's going on because they don't like him. And so he might be making some guesses or then making some statements and hearing how he said a wrong statement. Because in other words, the communication between the sheriff and the lead investigator might not be the best. And so that's why there might be conflicting issues too. But that doesn't mean that the investigation is not going the way it should. It means that their mouthpiece is not necessarily doing what he should. So
yeah,
I still, and this is different. And I apologize. This is, we've covered a lot of cases where I haven't been a fan in, either of the investigators, you know, that there's a lot of things that look shady, looked off, a lot of things. I'm not seeing that here. We're seeing a sheriff that his communication is not the best for what the public's looking for. And so, but again, on the investigative side, you would have more, think about this. If there was a lot of, because there's a lot of people in the kitchen, like you said, on this investigation, you got 400 people on the ground there. You got a lot of different agencies and organizations. I'm not hearing any internal strife between anyone on the ground there. There's no leakage of that coming out. So that's why I'm thinking, you know, there's good work being done on the ground because the only problem that people are having is with the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that means that's what might be where the problem is. And so not on the investigative side. Again, I'm always glass half full, so we'll see.
Is this an example of when you know, you have somebody in power, the sheriff Nanos, and prior to all of this even happening, take Nancy Guthrie out of the situation. He already had that like 98% vote of no confidence. He already had a lot of controversy around him for decades. He already had a lot of people that if you're the sheriff and you want to be an effective sheriff, you need those people on your side and you need them to be able to believe in you. And they don't. And they didn't. And they haven't. And they won't. So then something big happens and now there's suddenly all this attention on you. All of those votes prior ahead, those votes of no confidence, those expressions of no confidence, yet he sits there and still yields the power and holds the power and says, trust me, but nobody trusts him. Look, even if you do think you can do the best damn job in the world and your ego is that big and that no one else can possibly do better than you, you still need the other folks working with you and around you to be on your team. And it comes down from the top. Perception is going to be reality in some of these cases. And when you have this and you have especially internal strife, internal people who already don't like you, may not be wanting to work in your best interest or for you to have any sort of gains here, even though this is the type of situation it is. Isn't this just a prime example of when you're in that position, whether or not you're the best damn investigator in the world and you know it, if nobody believes in you, get the hell out of the kitchen. You will not be effective there for the greater good of what we're trying to do. And it's only your ego that's keeping you there. The rest of the cooks have already said, You're not the chef. You don't know what the hell you're doing. You may think you are. You may have the cookbook. You may have done this enough, but you're not good at it. Or nobody believes in you. And unless you have that team there, this is not going to work for you. But it seems it's like a battle of, I'm strong enough, we don't think you are, and everything in between. And it just creates far more chaos. And it ends up being about a person and not the actual goal of what the investigation and the case in hand is here.
Yeah, it's definitely distracting, and he's the sump of all things coming in that are negative here. And, you know, all you can do is try to place yourself in his shoes, again, always thinking that every human being is acting in what they think is their own best interest, and yeah. I'll give benefit of doubt of what he thinks is the best interest of the case and investigation. And the only thing I'm sure he's got his own reasons. He hasn't explained why he hasn't appointed someone else, or I think one of the reasons why he's saying less is just because of this. But also, for as much so again, here's a glass half full. He's drawn fire away from investigators. And so that might be helpful, because he's being in other words, he's a noise black hole. Everything goes to him, and so it keeps all the noise and distraction from the actual investigators themselves, which maybe they would have been flooded by, you know, having all these news reporters following them around or trying to figure out who they are and just inundating them. And maybe he's becoming that negative central focus point, so that everything gets sucked into him and keeps them allowed to do their job and business. So that's the only thing I kind of think of, that why he wouldn't be doing less or be more consistent.
It speaks to a lack of awareness of one's abilities and the ability and the awareness of one's the perception that one has, or lack of accepting it. I don't know. I mean, you get into dangerous territory there, where even if at the end of the day he's thinking he's doing the best thing, you're not. I mean, I don't necessarily think he's acting in any sort of like nefarious way, trying to like not get this investigation where it needs to be. But if you're just going to hit your head against a brick wall, then call it a day. I mean, it's up to him if he wants to put the FBI on the lead on this, and he's choosing not to, amongst the chaos and amongst basically votes of no confidence of everyone. That's on him. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not just trying to pile on the negativity of the sheriff, but it's like, dude, wake up. I mean, I saw somebody say, people bullying the sheriff. And it's not bullying. We're calling a spade a spade. These are documented reactions to this man for decades. This is not like, oh, I don't like him, or the investigation isn't going very far, so let's be critical. This is a track record. This is a history, a pattern of behavior that is does not have the greatest track record out there. Not even a good track record. So that it leads to far more questions, and it leads to far less confidence in a case where you need confidence, not only from the public, but certainly your own team.
You know, it's a neat observation. Bullying, as I saw that too. Thanks for popping that up, Todd. You know, bullying the sheriff. And so now here's an interesting take on that. From the sheriff's point of view, he probably feels like he's being bullied. And what happens when we feel like we're being bullied? We get insecure and we want to fight back against it. So you can understand the behavior pattern. Although that, like you said, that objectivity and having a loving critic saying, dude, you need to take a step back because our messaging's way off.
Yeah.
And the public is confused and you're eroding confidence in the investigation because of this inconsistency and incongruence about the messaging that's coming out, which makes a hell of a lot of sense of what you would think they would do. At the same time, you know, as you're sharing that, Tony, the other thing that struck me about this is there are not a lot of examples that from the case that you and I have covered where we could say that messaging was fantastic. These law enforcement guys got this messaging down. They're really good at it.
Yeah. You're right. I mean,
It fits, you know, so let's go back to my behavior arcs. So if we're looking at behavior arcs of public discussions and public notifications and spokespeople and media reps for law enforcement across the board, if he did really, really well, it'd be an outlier from what we expect, because it keeps falling short of what everyone always wants and needs. I'd say it's, and I remember when I was at the FBI Academy, And I was teaching there, the National Academy comes through there, and these are the top law enforcement professionals from all agencies across the United States and foreign as well, go through the National Academy for a period of time. They get credits towards advanced degrees through University of Virginia and other things. And one of the classes they have is public speaking and public affairs. And so, because it is definitely a critical need and a critical responsibility of the top of the organization to be able to speak coherently and publicly on all these critical cases with a lot of people's eyes on you. And this is a major failure in this case and in a lot of others.
Is that kind of like a throwaway class? Is it kind of like, and we're going to do this? because it feels like that is such an important piece to all of this. Maybe not necessarily to the investigation itself and the modality of the investigation, but having the public behind you and having that is critical. It is important. It certainly does affect the psyche. It affects the investigators. It affects morale if you have the larger group that you're working for backing you up, not sitting there criticizing your every move because somebody can't get through a five sentences without fucking it up. And that seems to be the problem. It's like it's such an important thing in so many, and I'm speaking broader terms here, not just this, but so many departments, it's like, oh, okay, the person that's going to literally drive the vehicle that's going to explain all this to the public, this huge asset of ours, the public, we're going to put the blind deaf guy on that and expect them to drive the ship and not crash it and be able to hear people. It feels like that's what they put out there so many times. It's like, what are you doing? This is not... Get somebody qualified for this position at the very least.
So, you know what it looks like? First of all, the training that they typically get, it's hard to imagine training that goes through a curriculum development and gets certified to be delivered to law enforcement professionals can keep up with the types of media that's going to be covering you. Because, I mean, just think about this. People like you and me and the hundreds of others, if not thousands of others, not just, you know, cable news, but people like us that have podcasts focusing on this that are going to do deeper dives in different areas and different nooks than the sheriff is even doing himself. And so what happens is that I don't think you can ever be prepared enough these days for these types of questions that people are going to be throwing you at a press conference. And people like us and all the others that are doing these deep dives, these nooks and crannies to ask all these important questions. And so what happens is he's going up there with a prepared statement over to one or two or three nuggets he has, and then he takes questions and thinks he can answer them. And that's where you get the wild ass guesses, the wags.
Yeah.
It's these wild ass guesses. He puts those things out there and then he gets contradicted by his investigative team that says, what are you saying? You never asked us that question before. Here's what the actual answer is. That's why it's wavering like this, because I think he's impromptu answering questions that he wasn't prepared for or didn't do the research on, because you got really, really smart people asking really intelligent questions that he never contemplated before. So, bam.
And then people like that need to have the confidence to say a few words, I don't know.
Yes.
We're looking into it.
See, and there's our own insecurities and his that can't say, I don't know yet. I'll find out for you and get back to you. I mean, and so think about this. I'll keep going back to that, to the head of the state police in Pennsylvania that was in charge of the Cavalcanti escape. Mm-hmm. He did such a good job at his press conferences because he would answer just like that. Here's the things he had prepared. Here's all his background. Here's who's doing whatnot. And when someone asked him a question that came out of left field that he wasn't ready for, he's like, you know what? It's a really good question. I'll get with my people. I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. I'll follow up with you. And they would then put something out on Twitter, on X, whatever, you know, to follow up on that question. So it wasn't like impromptu, but when someone has the confidence to say what they know, but actually the security in themselves and what they're doing to actually say what they don't know and be transparent about it, that's what trust is anchored in. Because remember, open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. That vulnerability thing, saying that here's what I know, here's what I don't know.
You want a leader that's confident enough to say, I don't know. That's not weakness. That's honesty. That's,
And good point that one listener just put up there. He's used to working with local news. Yeah. And when you're working with a friendly local news that is giving you, remember, 6 minutes. He's used to 6 minute sound bites. And so
it's a new world. I mean, it really, I mean, the world that they're having to navigate through, and so many, I think, cities and markets and officers and police forces have never had to do it yet, because this world of social media, the world of true crime reporting, is to the level we're at, it changes every year. We're more advanced than we were a year before, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's bigger than local media. It's bigger than network media. It is now the big thing. So it feels like a lot of these institutions, their PR departments, they were prepared for media circa 1995, and they've never really updated themselves in 30 years. Buckle up and get better, I guess would be the... The advice. Better. Yeah. Just get better. I mean, just get it. Times have changed. It's, you know, it's not just, you know, the newspaper, the radio station. It's all of this. It is what it is. It's not changing. If you'd like to be perceived better, then do better.
You know, it reminds me when I went through undercover certification school, my good friend Jack Schaefer, who wrote the book, The Like Switch and The Truth Detector, is one of the founding members of the behavioral analysis program inside the FBI. And he used to teach this advanced undercover course with me. And when you're being interrogated, say you're an undercover agent overseas and you're stopped and detained by a foreign power, and you only have so much information you can give in your bucket of who you are and your fake identity. And every time one of those things is gone, it's gone. You can never bring it back. But we had this thing called the Fort Knox defense. And the Fort Knox defense, I use it so much. I use it with my kids have used it. And with the Fort Knox defense is having one standard statement that is, you know, when you're asked a showstopper question that you don't have a response to, you have to have a standard answer that you always go back to that will, one, tire out the interviewer because they're going to get the same response, and it makes it so that you don't give them more to work with than you have to share. And so for me, when I was interviewing someone, say I was trying to recruit a source, a competent human source, or aspire to something, if they'd say to me, so Robin, did you follow me here today? Or Robin, how did you know I was here? Or Robin this. I said, you know what? My standard response is, wow, you know, Tony, that's a really important question you just asked, and I want to give it a lot of thought and time and intention. So instead of giving you a quick answer now, let me get back to you tomorrow on that. That's my standard Fort Knox. So anytime you ask me a question I'm not prepared for, that's my response. The sheriff lacks a Fort Knox response. And so that's what skilled interviewees do, is they have a fallback that, hey, here's my standard answer if it falls outside of this pattern. And so that's why he is failing in this area. He does not have it.
Sheriff, we want you to do better. Listen. Take some pointers. Your thoughts on the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue this part of the conversation there. 22 days, 23 days, I think, as of right now. Who's keeping track, though? The footage is everywhere. That grainy image of a masked man on Nancy Guthrie's porch has been broadcast nationally, shared millions of times, dissected on every platform. The FBI is showing photos to gun shop owners. Walmart is handing over purchase records for the Ozark Trail backpack. Genetic genealogy is processing DNA. If this person is local and the January reconnaissance suggests they might be, they're not hiding in a bunker. They're living their life while watching the walls close in. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us. Let's get into more about what might be going on with this individual today. If they're still out there somewhere, they've spent now almost 4 weeks watching themselves become the most wanted person in America. What does that sustained psychological pressure actually do to someone? I mean, how does it change their behavior in ways that people around them might be noticing?
So a lot depends. It's the worst answer always is it depends. Yeah. And it does depend. It depends if they're watching it or not. Because if they're laying so low that they're not paying attention, or they don't have access to social media, they don't have access to TV, they're not impacted very much by it at all, as well as the people around them. But here's interesting observation, though, on this one. In general, yes, people are going to always have that weight of the stress on them of what's going on, and always being in fight or flight. That has a massive physiological impact on our bodies, a very negative one over a sustained period of time. And so in general, yes, that kind of sustained pressure will start cracking. It will start ebbing out with all the behaviors of people around them. It becomes extremely notable. Here's a few interesting things, though, with that. And the first one is just this person's demeanor on that front porch. Remember, there hasn't been a living soul that has covered this that didn't say it looked fluid. He looked comfortable doing it. It looks like he has some reps doing this. And so that shows that he was not stressed in that moment on the front porch. And so there's a possibility that's just his demeanor. He doesn't get stressed about these things, which would not give them a lot of leakage outside of that thing, even with the enhanced intention on him. Also, what happens that I did the research I did on this one was the levels of connectivity, because the sheriff and others put out there that they're not ruling out other accomplices. Accomplices is an interesting word. People knowledgeable maybe of his lifestyle of being a burglar, breaking an entry, things like this. There might be people aware of that. And so his pattern could be, well, he does a burglary once a week. And so once a week he comes back stressed. And meantime, in other words, if it's a normal pattern behavior for breaking an entry and the people around him know that, it's going to fall in that normal pattern of behavior. So it won't necessarily be standing out. Then you also have three types of individuals that might be aware of him. And those are family members that are potentially involved, accomplices, or just witting. You have friends and associates, which is that next level. And then you have more relative strangers that you just more like a hired hand. And at each level, their willingness to hide, corroborate, and back you is obviously declining. So the close one, the family members, their likelihood of them turning you in or cracking in some way or being alerted to, granted, they're the ones that are going to be most alerted to your behavior. But if it's a pattern of things you've done before, it might look normal. Even it gets tricky, but yeah, it just gets tricky.
Investigators have been canvassing gun shops with the doorbell footage, asking if anyone recognizes the holster. Apparently, they've had a list of names, too, that they've been going around with photos. They're running Walmart purchase records for the backpack. The perpetrator knows, if they're paying attention, that investigators are methodically building a trail back to them. At least they're attempting to. In your experience, you know, what do people do when they realize that the noose is tightening? Or, I mean, I think we're looking at this going, oh, that noose must be tightening, unless it's like, I didn't buy it at Walmart. Y'all think I did that. You know, I didn't do this. See, I didn't go to a gun shop. Y'all think I did that. I mean, they could be looking at this going, ha, they thought I did these things. They're looking in all the wrong places. I mean, they may be thinking they're scot-free. I don't know, which could also be not a great tell for them, because it could lead them to be sloppy at some point. What do you think's going on here? Running? They're destroying evidence? From what we're looking at here with what we do know about this person, which is not a lot, what do you think is going on behind the scenes?
We don't know a lot. I'm really curious about what they do know behind the scenes, especially on the forensic evidence of this. We don't know. I mean, we know some of the DNA stuff that's come in, obviously, but not, I mean, we know it's not a CODIS hit, but now they're going to do the genealogical trees, which again, we'll see if anyone in the family's ever had anything entered in there. So again, these things take some time to flesh out. If even 50 to 75% of the evidence that's coming in is accurate to, in other words, that noose is closing, that is putting added pressure on there. And I know that we have the ransom out there, we have the reward money that's been posted out there. I did research on this as well. Reward money for people that are close to the individual for turning them in is rarely, if ever, the motivator for turning them in. It's actually... Mm-hmm. Public statements of the evidence of what we found that actually becomes a noose tightening. So the person themselves is probably condensing closer and closer and getting tighter and tighter and tighter, more stressed, trying to suppress everything they can emotionally, as well as any kind of physical evidence that they want to get rid of. And at the same time, the people around them, if anyone knows about it, the most common thing they're going to start doing is they're going to start getting into their own survival mode. Because if they think that the perception is that law enforcement is getting closer, they want to either cut a deal, They want to avoid jail time because they fear prison more than they want $200,000 in most of these cases. And so what's happening around here is that that's why I'm hoping that these investigators keep leaking things out. That's why I really like that they had names that they're going to the gun shops with. My next big thing I really hope that we get, I'm hoping we get something from Walmart. That would be huge, I think, in applying even more pressure, because what law enforcement needs to do now is saying we're closer, and provide evidence that they're closer, because if anyone is close to him, we're now in that window of the time period. Believe it or not, we are now starting to be in that prime window. If someone was going to turn him in and give a tip that's going to lead to him, is right now. It wasn't before this necessarily. We're in that window. So if law enforcement could come out with one or two more things to add to that pressure, we might get a flip in here.
Let me ask you this. Is someone who does have knowledge of who this person is, whoever that is that's out there, or whoever, maybe there's more than one person, if they know who it is, the reward keeps getting higher. The dollar, you know, I know we're up to like 300,000, I think. I haven't checked it this morning, but I think that's what it was over the weekend. People keep adding to this reward. I'm going to guess this is going to keep going higher. I mean, that dollar amount, I know rewards don't always move the needle a lot, but if it gets to the point of life-changing money where someone could be like, I could take that if it's $1 million, for example, and like I can get out of Dodge. I can go disappear. I can go start a life somewhere else. A couple $100,000, it'll get you by for a while, without a doubt. But it's not necessarily I'm off the radar. I'm off the grid. And if you're in a situation where you're close enough to know who this person is, there might be some danger to you if you were to go and speak aloud or turn that person in. Should anyone who is close to this person start being concerned for their own safety, the higher that reward gets, because that person may be thinking, oh, well, they're not going to flip on me on 300 grand, but if it go to $1 million, they may flip on me and they'd be better off dead than them flipping on me. I mean, are we getting to a crossroads here at some point of people really considering, is it best just to stay quiet? Or if I stay quiet, is that fear going to influence that person to turn on me because I have that knowledge? Is it a better move for me to go and turn on that person versus risk my own safety because of that person's paranoia of their own exposure? Considering we've been going now for almost a month, the person, you know, clearly, you know, is okay so far with not with living with this, if they're still alive,
right,
as being something that they've done.
You know, it's a really good question too. And so I'm going to go back to my original conjecture that this was a home invasion. I know that some people don't like this, but I'm just going I stick with law of averages till data says otherwise. And that right now, the law of averages, 60% probability that this was a home invasion for burglary that had a panic escalation where something happened to her inside that house and removed the body. With that as a conjecture, I do not believe that he went in there to do her harm intentionally. So the type of individual that is going to burglarize and steal as opposed to intentionally murder are two different types of people in general. And so if this person is not violent, the people in their lives might not fear violence from this person. So they don't fear, I better do it now or they're going to take me out. So again, I think that goes into the calculation that a lot of times we don't dive deep enough to think about. I really think, again, from just our own deep empathetic conjecture and thought process, as well as the stats, the thing that really ramps things up is when they think they're going to go to jail. That is usually the prime motivator, is their fear of their own. Remember, our prime motivator in life is fear.
Yeah.
And if they fear going to jail, which is usually the prime flipper of people close to someone, that is the main motivator. I don't think that there's fear. I think this is close. I think the people in this relationship to him are close.
I guess the interesting thing is, if it is exactly that, if it is a burglary gone wrong, this person was not a killer. This person wasn't even a kidnapper. It was, oh God, what do we do now? And let's get rid of the evidence, which would have been Nancy. If that's what that was, and now they're sitting somewhere, but they've been basically in a pressure cooker for 4 weeks at this point, that's a very different ingredient coming out of that pot than went in. So that person who might not have been a killer 4 weeks ago ended up, but somehow became one, or somehow became close to being one for whatever happened with Nancy, if she's no longer with us. Well, they've checked that box off their list of things they never thought that they would do or have done.
Right.
And if you got folks around you who might know who you are, and they didn't think of you as a killer either, but now you really don't want to go to jail, and you've already got one under your belt, what's another two or three or four if it's going to keep you, if it's going to keep you safe? I mean, that sort of, because you got to go to that person's fear factor too. And people will do extreme things under extreme pressure, things like that, that they might not have never have done before. We might be dealing with a very different mindset of a human being today than they were 4 weeks ago.
So yes-ish.
Yes-ish. Okay.
And I love, and Todd's putting all these great comments up there. There's lots of, I never just like all these different theories about what's going on. I love entertaining them all. And I do. I entertain every single theory that comes out there, and I just flush it out. What's the intent? What actions are we seeing that actually support that theory? And same thing right here, Tony, is that, so let's play this out. So what's the probability that this individual reached a point that they kind of, you know, they broke the mold. All right, we killed one person, potentially. Might as well just keep going. With all this mounted pressure, you know, so there's less inhibition for it. So in order for that to be, the likelihood is very remote, and here's why. Because if there was someone in this entire area and vicinity that spiked out of the norm, that had violence, burglary, that had escalated or numerous burglaries before, and they are on the record, we would have interviewed them already. And we had the DNA inside the house. They would have popped up on CODIS. And so, because everyone who's arrested gets entered into CODIS. And so if there had been someone that's edging up, you know, that was ready to flip over to from burglary to murder, It wouldn't have been a far leap, and there would have been an arc of people that would have already been identified in here. And so in general, if we look at the fact that no one has turned them in yet, if there's anyone that knows about their behavior, it's most likely someone very close, a familiar relation in some way, either blood or by marriage or relationship. People like that, that don't fear that individual. In other words, fear is what people flip on. Loyalty is something they don't. And so if someone, in other words, if they feared that this person would take reciprocity against them, the likelihood of them flipping is actually greater.
Yeah.
And so I don't get the feeling that there's good with this kind of period that's passed. I'm not getting a sense of fear that's going on internally. I think the wagons might be circling on this until it reaches that point where they fear going to jail.
Let me throw this one out to you, because we're going to talk about the accomplice theory in a moment. But before we get to that, one more on this. I don't know what sort of stats exist on this. I don't know if there are stats on something like this. But, you know, we see a lot of tragedies take place where typically more public ones, where it's like a shooter somewhere, where it's like at a school or a store, an office or whatever, and then they end up taking themselves out at the end of it. What are the odds that somebody, that this went horribly wrong, that they, you know, they went in for the burglary, they accidentally killed her, she died, whatever, and then they decided, oh, they couldn't deal with that, and, you know, this was far beyond what they were expecting, and that they're dead too, and that's why we're not finding anything on them, because they literally ended around the same time, God forbid, Nancy did too, if it was around the beginning of the month.
So murder-suicide is actually pretty common when it comes to vengeance type things, mm-hmm. or wound collecting type actions, murder, suicide, and I'd have to look it up. But it's definitely in the realm of possibility that, you know, mm-hmm. the remorse hit them so to such a large degree, they might've just offed themselves. That's a possibility.
Would that fit more in line if this was not necessarily more of a B&E, but more of some sort of a crazed Savannah Guthrie fan or something, where, you know, I want to communicate with you, I want to reach you, so I'm going to do it by going to someone that's very close to you, and who knows what the intention was, maybe not have been to murder, but I'm going to take Nancy, and she's old, she's fragile, and she died, and like, oh God, that went horribly wrong, and now my idol isn't going to be happy because I just killed her mom, or her mom died in my hands. I'm going to end it. I mean, that, I guess could be another, anything could be a possible storyline here. But I mean, just when you try to play the odds of the mindset, like, well, what would motivate them to be doing those sort of things in these specific scenarios?
So, and that's a great thing to flesh out. I love these different theories, because let's just flesh it out. So what we're basically talking about, Tony, is stalker kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so if someone's stalking Savannah, someone wants to get to Savannah through her mom or whatever it is. Okay, let's play that out. Here's the averages on that. Stalkers at that level, they journal, they write it down, they have manifestos. There's digital patterns, and there's a lot of forensics when it comes to people that are stalking. Because remember, let's go back. I've said it numerous times. I hate repeating myself, but sometimes it works. And that is, you know, What else? I'm trying to remember the name of the book that John Douglas, you know, the profiler, wrote a lot of good books. Yeah. This one was all about motive. And he said, a lot of people are always looking for the motive, but it's so much easier to focus in on the intent. And so let's look at the intent, because now actions have to then back up the actual intent. So let's presume the intent here is what you said. Well, what would the intent be? The intent would be to get closer to Savannah, you know, some stalker of Savannah. Great. If you're going to do that, there's going to be a lot of notes. There's going to be a lot of intelligence gathering, information gathering, they journal. So these are things that stalkers do. You know, Joe Navarro, one of my good friends who wrote the book Dangerous Personalities, talks a lot about stalkers in that book as well and their behaviors. And so there's a lot of telltale signs of that. That if there was a stalker of this type, whether it was because they were enamored with Savannah or her mom, or they had some malicious intent, there's nefarious intent, whatever kind of stalking we're talking about here, whether it's for obsessive in some way, there is a pattern of behavior that would have been discoverable that they would have come out with already.
Yeah.
That's why, I mean, it really comes down to is like, all right, does the data that we see support the hypothesis right now from what has been shared with us? It does not.
It doesn't. No, you're exactly right. There's always outliers. Those can exist, but it's important to kind of stay grounded and on the right
and
rails.
And I never dismissed out it's important news. I know sometimes people say, no, this is. I never dismiss outliers. I love flushing it out, and we remain open as investigators to all possibilities. Mm-hmm. But when you have limited bandwidth, what happens is you start prioritizing the less probable. You prioritize a higher probability based on stats and background.
Yeah. Everybody's thoughts in the comment section on this area, on the mind of the individual. Where do you think they are? What's your opinions? Give us your thoughts in our Substack comments and on YouTube. The links are in the descriptions. The Pima County Sheriff's Department has publicly stated they're not ruling out that multiple people were involved in the Nancy Guthrie abduction. That's not necessarily new news. They've never ruled anything out because nobody knows. The evidence, though, is contradictory. Sophisticated reconnaissance versus sloppy execution, insider knowledge of a home versus a ransom system with no way to collect payment. If this was more than one person, a partnership, a crew, someone who drove while someone else went inside, the dynamics change completely. Partnerships fracture under pressure. Someone always knows something. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is with us. Robin, investigators have said they're not ruling out multiple people being involved in the abduction. When you look at this this full evidence pattern, you got the weeks of reconnaissance, forensic, seemingly somewhat awareness of the door, the dropped, I mean, if the glove has anything to do with it, which I'm going to go with no, we have no vehicle identified, right. The ransom notes with no collection mechanism. So a lot of it's noise there. does this read to you as one person operating alone or a partnership, or is it one person operating alone over here and then a bunch of people that have tacked on going, I'd like to operate in this and collect some money. I have nothing to do with this. But there seems to be the idea that there could be multiple individuals here. How close to reality does that fly to the sun?
So far, there is no evidence that we've seen that's been publicly made that insinuates, and also from that statement, that they remain open to the fact that there might be accomplices or other people involved. Just means that they haven't ruled it out, because the probability isn't zero. The law of averages, again, that's why you saw me glancing as you're doing your intro. So I wrote my numbers down. Likelihood of accomplice is less than 30% for elderly. So 60 mm-hmm. to 70% probability that this was a solo act, on top of the fact that there's no evidence saying there was anyone else involved yet, says that most likely it's a solo act. And it's just because nothing is flushed out that says it wasn't a solo act. Doesn't mean that other people aren't witting, potentially, kind of like we were talking about in the last segment. But for the actions themselves in the place itself, there's nothing that says anyone else is involved, and laws of probability based on past cases and research, especially with the elderly, because this comes into play, because there's always stats on these things, and then it becomes even more improbable when you give her age. So that's what really makes this one even more solid in my background, in my head, about the things I'm saying, is because it's low probability that it's anything but a home invasion. Even more so with the age. There's low probability that there's an accomplice, even less probable given her age. And so her age makes all these other things even tighter, because the averages on just the elderly being targeted in this way are so remote.
Does it make it even less likely now that we're a month into this, basically, and we have had no leakage? I mean, if you have one person doing it, it's probably where we're at right now, maybe. But if you have more people, that opens up the door, doubles your chances, double your fun with double mint gum. But in this case, it would be, you know, doubling your chances of going away for the rest of your life or dying. When you have more people involved, that's certainly going to increase. And the fact that we haven't seen much of anything come out, does that point to even more likelihood that this was some loan nut or burglary gone wrong? I don't even want to say nut. I mean, because you don't have to be a nut for the burglary just to go wrong.
Right.
It could just a lone person that again, the intent was to go, you know, steal jewelry or whatever. And this is what we got.
Yeah. So we mentioned in the last segment, there's typically three types of groups that could be potential accomplices in these things. You have the family and close relations, you have the you got the friends and coworkers, and then you have strangers or loose partner affiliations. Here's the averages on it. If there was, and that's why right now I'm saying, if there was an accomplice, it's someone who's very close to this individual, because the law, the probability on someone flipping with in a close family relationship like that is only around 20%. 20 to 35%. If it's a more of a professional relationship, like they've worked together or they work together in the same job, we're talking around 45 to 60%. And then we're up to like 70 to 80%, or 60 to 70%, really, for someone who's even less affiliated. So family members, really less likely, around 20% are going to flip at this stage, about 4 weeks in. That's why that gets increased, that probability increases the more that fear of going to jail gets in there, the more the sheriff or anyone can put out information that says, hey, here's more data, says we're closing the noose, because that actually ramps up that pressure of someone closer, which if there is anyone involved, I think it's someone closer to flip.
Well, and the reality is, if somebody would flip here, especially if this was not a murder, if this it was an abduction, she was injured, something happened that nobody like pulled a trigger and shot her or whatever. It's whoever, if there's multiple people here, they got to be thinking, at least maybe they should start thinking of, hey, it's going to be a battle of who's going to be exonerated and who's not. One, somebody's going to put somebody else away for the rest of their lives. You know, and you may end up getting some time on there, but one's going to be far worse than the other. So who do you want to be? I think is kind of where, if there are multiple people here, that they should be taking into consideration. Would you like to be the one that turns the person in? Maybe you get a sweetheart deal and you get nothing. You can walk free for the rest of your life, or you can wait for them to finally catch up with you, which may take a while, but they'll get there at some point. You can take that gamble and live in paranoia for the rest of your life, or you can flip and turn the person in. Do you think, I mean, this is how, I guess, you know, a rational person on the outside looks at it. Is this how a criminal looks at it from the inside?
It's always important never to give too much credence to how hard these people are thinking.
Yeah, true.
My thought, I think right now they're probably thinking about how to escape. if there's, mm-hmm. if, you know, either one person or two people or three people max, because that's also the law of probabilities too. Is like, if there is any more people involved, it's only one to two more max. I'm thinking that the only thing they're thinking of right now is, can we get across a border someplace, and how fast, and how do we do it?
If they've not already done so.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that would be something that's probably already been accomplished, if that's what they're doing. Let's talk about the reward as of right now. It keeps going up. Like I said, as of right now, I believe it's a little bit over 300,000. I don't have it in front of me. Again, it's not quite, you know, world changing money or, you know, I'm going to go off the grid type changing money. Does that need to go up? I mean, obviously, you have two things that occur when you put really high rewards up. You're encouraging other people to go do horrible things for large rewards. And you can also sometimes inspire people to talk if they know that they're going to be truly taken care of, not just their next car payment or buying a new car, which that can be about what a car is, 100 grand these days. So what do you think? The reward should go up. Are you surprised the reward hasn't gone higher at this point? What's your take on where that's at right now?
It's feeling pretty good. I mean, it's at a point where it would motivate some, because so rewards are good at generating tips and leads. Because what it forces people to do is, as that number rises, I mean, just think about this, you know, when does the Powerball number get high enough where people who generally don't buy a Powerball, they finally buy one? Mm-hmm. It's the same type of thing here. So it reaches that certain level, and we're at that level right now where it actually makes people say, wow, you know, $50,000 wouldn't make a huge difference. Well, I mean, it would make a difference in everyone's life, but for a lot of people, they're not going to rack their brain so hard because all right, it's not just 50, but it's $50,000. But now that we're in the multiple hundreds of thousands, it forces people to really think harder about the last couple months of their lives, who they saw, what they didn't see. And it forces people to actually submit leads that they might have otherwise have dismissed because they didn't think it was a big deal. Because we're really, really good at our confirmation biases to dismiss things we wouldn't otherwise dismiss. In other words, rewards force people to think of things that they otherwise would have dismissed, and that could have been the thing that broke the case. That's why when rewards go up, leads go up, and a lot of times it's the leads, not from someone close, but someone who had like a worker. In other words, if you are like, she had pool maintenance done, mm-hmm. say that your pool maintenance company, you have three guys that come to your house or two guys that come to your house once a month for your pool maintenance. And all of a sudden after this thing happens, you notice that Jose no longer shows up, or when he shows up, he's really distracted and never was before. You know, that kind of thing you would dismiss. But when someone turns a reward up to 300,000, you're like, huh, what do I got to lose? Let me turn Jose's name in. And you never know. It could be that one. So that's kind of the effect that rewards have on people. Things that they otherwise might have dismissed, they'll probably call in. And then what happens is it goes through that baseline again, like we talked about in segment one. It goes along the baseline. All right, lead tip comes in. Let's flush it through this. Let's flush it through this. Let's flush it through this. Eventually, they go interview the guy or they do some research. And what they're always trying to do is they're not trying to catch someone. They're trying to eliminate him as a possibility. And so that's the process. That's a mental thing that investigators do. They're trying to eliminate people from possibilities, because the more people you eliminate, you're only left with the one who actually did it.
You need to inspire someone to come forward and speak if they know something about it. And when you have chaos around the investigation and there's danger that could be introduced into someone's life for coming up and speaking, that's not very inspiring. That's not going to make you go, oh, if I go and speak, they're going to protect me. They can barely seem to handle themselves. That's a big deal. Should we be looking at this in a different way other than money? And I don't know what can be offered. I mean, you don't really see this very often, but I'm wondering if maybe it should be offered more than cash, or maybe in combination of cash, to inspire people to speak. Because it's not just cash that's going to save the day. Number one, you better hope to God you can get the cash, and they're not going to find some way of backing out of that. And, oh, you're not quite qualified for this, while you're trying to survive after you've just snitched on someone. Promising security, promising safety, promising a new life away from whatever wretched existence someone may have if this is the person that's in your life. I can't imagine it's the best of the best. Should they be looking at more things like this for cases like this, offering security, offering a way out? Because I bet there's a lot of people around people like this that would love nothing better to have their name changed to Doe and them living in Montana on a farm where no one will ever see them again after the trauma and shit shows that they've been through in their life. We don't seem to offer that. It's just cash. That's not always a motivating factor for people. Security is.
I really like the idea of that, because so I've really liked Savannah's messaging and the family's messaging they've had when they've made their statements. Very empathetic. You had the one transactional one, but the rest are very empathetic. Mm-hmm. I would think, again, when you're just thinking things psychologically, so it costs you nothing to put out messaging, right? And especially well-crafted messaging can really be a beautiful thing to do. So imagine this. And so here's an idea, riffing off of what you said, Tony. If you actually put law enforcement together with Savannah and put together a joint message about that, about how we put a program together for someone to come forward with the tip that will lead us to the bad guy, or to the individual that got caught up in this. See, your messaging and language covers so much.
And that had a bad day.
you know, because you got Savannah's family saying, "Hey, we're able and willing to grant grace, not forgiveness, but grace. Maybe forgiveness. That's all up to them." And have law enforcement say, "Listen, here's how this will roll. Here's how we're going to make this happen. Here's how we're going to." So it'd be, because, like you said, the fear factor, because when you have chaos with messaging that we're seeing from law enforcement or non-existent, it doesn't bode well to allow you to feel safe. So if you had a joint thing together with law enforcement and the Guthrie family saying, here's our offer for someone or someones that want to come forward, here's what we can do. You know, I think it's a powerful thing that would, I think that's a really powerful thing to do. Why not, right?
Why not? I mean, I feel like it could be so helpful in so many cases. We overlook that as being a lever to pull, as a factor. And yes, I know there's a witness protection relocation program.
It doesn't really fall into that.
It doesn't fall into that. But something, we should have a lever that can be pulled for these sort of situations that's going to be the lever that people want. It's not always just going to be cash. Cash isn't going to necessarily protect you for the rest of your life. A system that suddenly changes your identity and gets you out of Dodge, that does. And especially if there's motivation to protect their own children and get them out of said shit situation, well, Here's the opportunity you never thought was coming. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I don't know if the levers exist within our system to do it, but certainly something to consider for the folks that can make those choices.
I want to point out, so Todd, that one comment you just put up there about maybe one of the intents was to sow distrust. That is actually one I can entertain, because if the intent is to sow distrust in organizations, institutions, law enforcement, yes, that worked.
I've been saying that from day one.
Always. So again, this is what we do. We flush these things out. So I would say that's more probable than a cartel coming in and taking her. It just, because that doesn't flush out. Because when you look at intent, do all the things and all the data points line up with that intent? And so that, so because a byproduct of what's going on now is we have this trust in law enforcement and institutions.
Yep.
So that actually works. I don't know whether it was the actual intent or not, but that is definitely the result. So I would entertain that.
If that was just the goal, they have succeeded. I mean, and it just like little nugget app. We look at it as such a big thing because, I mean, Savannah's a big character. You know, she's well known. So this must be big, and the crime must match. Who it was perpetrated upon. Not always the case.
Nah.
Sometimes, especially if it's a foreign actor or something that was in here, and it's simply, well, this is a great little nugget I can throw into the American psyche to piss everybody off and turn them against each other and sow discord against law enforcement and distrust. And at the end of the day, all it costs me is Nancy Guthrie. And I'm saying that from the perspective of someone who doesn't give a shit.
Right.
I don't know, from the beginning, I felt like we might be in some sort of a world like that. I don't know what or why, or if there's a deeper reason or deeper distrust that is trying to be sown. But I thought of that right away of like, is this just another thing that's designed to stir the pot?
Possibly. But now I'm going to throw the wet towel on that.
Okay.
On theory. Only because I have been part of these things and literally part of these things in the Bureau where everyone's always thinking it's a state actor doing these things for X, Y, and Z. So always ask yourself this question. For everyone that has a job, do you ever have extra time and energy and resources to spend screwing around with someone, or are you too busy keeping up with your own shit? So that actually is state actors as well. Very, very rarely, if ever, does a state actor go way above and beyond with limited resource to screw with someone. Active measures, yes, when it comes to state actors, like interfering with elections and things like that, using active measures like the Russians did, using Nova Ruskoye Slova and all the things they do to interfere, because that is good bang for the buck at the state level, state level. But to get down into the weeds of this granular level, I have never seen it.
I don't know. I mean, Robin, look at social media and all of the Russian actors that are there. I mean, there's fake things everywhere on social media that are designed simply to sow distrust and discord. There's actually one on this case. I've been meaning to send it to you. I've gotten people that have sent it to me going, what is this all about? And it took me about 5 minutes to like go, what the hell is this? There's videos out there right now, and it's being, I don't know if it's Russia, if it's China, somebody's doing it, and they're AI-created videos, and they look like a very academic individual talking for about 30, 40 minutes about Nancy Guthrie's involvement in some sort of a pharmaceutical case where she was going to testify. None of it's true. All utter bullshit.
Right.
None of it is a lick of reality to it. But if you watch this video, you'd be like, oh God, what is this? I took the video transcript and I threw it into everything going, what is this about? Like, am I missing something? All bullshit. But thousands and thousands of people are watching this. People have commented on here going, was she involved in some sort of farm? No, she wasn't.
Right.
That's complete and utter propaganda bullshit designed to make us mad at each other, designed to make us angry at the healthcare system and the things we're already inclined to be angry at, and just stir the pot more. But they're using it with the Nancy Guthrie case. And they're doing it all the time. And these things are getting so hard to tell whether it's real or not, because they're not just some weird TikTok video or this or that. This looked like an academic sitting there talking in front of his computer. Not real. Not real at all. It took me 5 minutes to figure out if it was real. If it's taking me 5 minutes to figure out if it's real, most people aren't realizing that it's not real. That's a scary thing in this. So is it that far of a leap for them to go, we're going to go beyond just this. We're going to actually cause the events that then we're going to pack on here online and stir the pot with?
No. And here's why. Tony, you did a great job explaining exactly what they do. They take an organic event and then they cascade distrust on top of it.
Okay.
And so it takes, because remember, if you're going to take time, money, and resources to initiate an event, you're guessing whether it's going to work or not. It's so much easier to take the time, money, and resources to cascade on top of something that happened organically, because it's already off and running. All you have to do is, in other words, the ship is already moving. All you got to do is kind of shift that rudder one way or the other. It takes a lot more to get the ship moving altogether. And so that, again, large nation states don't initiate something from ground zero in things like this. They will take something organic and then shape mm-hmm. that narrative through active measures.
Sure.
In other words, the Russians did not decide to have Hillary Clinton run against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. They took that organic thing and then shifted it to sow distrust in our processes here. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what your videos you just brought up, exactly that exact thing. They took something organic and tried to shift it. It's just like this, I'm called the spear phishing when it comes to the ransom notes. That took something organic and tried to capitalize for their own profit. And so exactly the same thing here. So that's why I'm not on the side of it was someone behind this that did it intentionally. I think they took an organic thing that happened, some tragedy, and now other people are trying to cascade on and sow distrust because of it. Makes sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. No, that's why I love when I see these things. I'm like, I got to ask Robin about this.
Yeah, I love talking about this stuff. It's good stuff.
Everybody's thoughts in the comment section. I got to take a sip of water. I'm going to cough. Everybody's thoughts in the comment section. We'd love to see it on Substack or on YouTube. The links are in the description. We'll continue the conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts or watching us so you don't miss any of our coverage on this and the many cases we watch for you right here. Until next time, for Todd and Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.